television or have children and remain the exact same. What's never going to change? Of course, our values, our priorities, our commitment to each other and my family. But I hope that literally every other part of my life does change. I hope that every new season and every new situation of life changes me. Some people I know show enormous resistance to modifying even a fraction of themselves. They're not about to shift the way they think or what they think they know. They simply expect others to get with the program, to adjust their mindset and fall into their exact way of thinking. How ignorant for any one of us to assume that we have a monopoly on the right perspective and no one else could possibly hold a piece of this puzzle. And how arrogant to just demand that people change for us without ever making the effort to know them as a human being first and to understand where they're coming from. I wonder if being angrily shouted at or arrogantly debated with has ever swayed a single person. Are human hearts moved by being ridiculed and mocked? When people fling accusations with the presumption of knowing other people's intentions, what possible outcome could they be hoping for? Who would ever move to the enemy's camp under such treatment? I really believe that we won't get anywhere, that no healing or breakthrough can occur apart from developing actual relationships with one another. As much as I love Twitter, Twitter feuds aren't going to cut it. Actually connecting requires true face-to-face time, and that's where the ditch comes in. I believe with all my heart that it's only after working side by side with another person that you can earn the right to speak into that person's life. It's a basis of friendship that can forge a path forward to common ground. The ditch is where the trust is built. And then it's at the dining room table, laden with lovingly prepared food, that walls come down. It's around the table that you discover you might, in fact, love this person you were pretty sure you were supposed to hate. It's here that both sides are heard and hearts begin to open and change. Maybe not wholly. This isn't some manipulative act where the goal is to win someone over to your side. The goal is listening and truly hearing. It's letting your guard down and letting your heart open up a bit. The goal is to leave the table no longer as strangers or even enemies, but as fellow travelers on this journey of life. Maybe you even leave as friends who have just chosen to agree to disagree on some things. This is where hate and fear begin to lose their grip. This is where you begin to have each other's back, even when you can't fully embrace each other's perspectives. The truth is, we don't have to agree on everything to be friends, but a lot of people seem to think that's the case. That popular and toxic lie has taken our beautiful planet and turned it into a battleground. The assumption is, if you don't think like me, not only are you wrong, but you are bad and possibly even evil. Judging others' intentions is a nasty business. I'm convinced we do best to steer clear of that entirely. Even just in my own life, I am amazed at the ways that my heart has been misunderstood. It's character assassination. And where I come from, a person's most valuable possession is his or her character. I'm all for disagreeing on the issues. That's the beauty of being unique creatures with different thoughts and opinions and perspectives. How boring would it be if we all agreed on everything? I'm so thankful that there's a whole wide world of individual points of view and we're not some sci-fi tragedy of collective thinking. But when it goes from having opposing viewpoints to actually maligning the other person's character, then there's something wrong. Challenge opinions all day long. I get that. But at least save your assessment of who someone is until after you've gotten to know him or her. It seems to me that we Americans are in an all-out war in this regard. It doesn't feel too terribly far off to think that World War III could break out over just an exchange of words. When contempt has become the norm and misinformation runs rampant, it makes way for a kind of rhetoric that may only be silenced by absolutism. Not trying to be an alarmist here, but I am deeply concerned. Let me lay out my strategy to try to counter this tendency. Basically, it's a matter of rolling up our sleeves and learning to work with the people who don't think the way we do. From there, it's a lot of gathering around a dining room table and eating lots of great food and talking. There's only one rule at these dinners. If you come to share, you also have to come prepared to hear what is being said. Actually, it's not enough to just hear. You have to listen. My hope is that each of these meals would contain long periods of quiet, other than, of course, some chewing sounds or some sipping, maybe the strains of the Simon and Garfunkel album playing in the other room, as well as the almost imperceptible sounds of hearts being split wide open. The Bible has quite a bit to say on loving your neighbor, as do nearly all of the sacred texts of the major world religions. But how do we actually love our neighbors? I mean, do we even understand who qualifies as our neighbor? Are they the people who only live in the homes directly adjacent to us? Or are they the people in our city? Or is it our country? Or are all the residents of planet Earth considered our neighbors? I prefer the last answer. I want to live in a world where we all consider each other as neighbors, where every person's voice matters. I'm convinced that every child on this earth is valuable and worthy of dignity and respect. There is no chance for any of us to see eye to eye if we are unwilling to even look in each other's directions. Hate masquerading as righteousness can sit in every church pew on Sunday morning, and no one even bats an eye. Contempt and judgment clothed in concern says more about the quote-unquote concerned than the concerning, if you catch my drift. I am thankful to be friends with all types of people. I've got tall friends, fat friends, funny, intelligent, not that smart, athletic, artistic, and every shade of skin under the sun, plus gay, straight, Muslim, Christian, Buddhist, Jewish, and I've even got a few atheist buddies. Obviously, this is not a completely exhaustive list, and it's preposterous for me to suggest that I could be personal friends with every type of person on the planet. But these are some of the common labels that society uses to mark us all for exclusion. If I had my way, we would all just be considered people. There are no boxes that I'm looking to check by saying that. There's no notch in the belt or pat on the back that I'm looking for. I'm simply a better person for knowing lots of different kinds of people. They make me a better man. If any of these people are ever in a ditch and need a hand, I hope I'm the first person to happen past. I believe that we are all children of God, the whole lot of us. This means that we are all inherently beautiful, flawed as we are. We all have truth and goodness within us, and our lives are created with intentionality. We were born for a purpose. Every person that you happen on in your lifetime has a story to tell. Every person on the planet has the ability to teach us something, if we'll only be willing to listen. President Abraham Lincoln famously built a team of rivals to advise him, a cabinet filled with people of opposing views and from different political factions. He even included three men in that group who had run directly against him in the election. Where do you think Lincoln's famous "house divided" quote came from? He was living this thing out, and he knew he was better off with the people who were willing to challenge his point of view. President Lincoln knew that the country would be better served by politicians learning to wrestle beyond the divide than by a homogeneous, partisan set of officials always getting their way. I think we desperately need a team of rivals, ditch-digging, dinner-table approach to making connections with one another. I wish it were the norm for Republicans to mostly just tune into CNN or NPR. I wish that Democrats were on a steady diet of Fox News. Mainly, I just wish we would all put ourselves in a position of listening. We can yell at the screen, get mad or sad all we want, as long as we engage, hear, and truly try to understand what the other side is actually fighting for. It can only be good if we stand where they stand, take in the landscape from their perspective for a bit. Rather than ridicule, belittle, we can choose to acknowledge why they are so passionate about what they are passionate about. These battle lines drawn down the center of our country's soul seem to be costing us our humanity. We stereotype and mock entire people groups merely because they think differently or look differently than we do. The oversimplified strokes that we paint each other with isn't just hateful, it's ignorant. If we could get a handle on what this whole team of rivals thing is all about, we just might become formidable in a way that the world has never seen. Early in 2016, the Elite Cafe, one of Waco's oldest restaurants, closed down after nearly 100 years of doing business. One of its great claims to fame was that it had the honor of feeding the Elvis Presley back in the day. When it closed its door for the last time, I barely hesitated before making an offer on this great piece of real estate. Joe and I have wanted to open up a breakfast joint for years now. Hospitality is a big part of what we're trying to do here at Magnolia, so the restaurant business really seemed to fit. The Elite Cafe is a big part of Waco's history, and we wanted to honor that legacy. So we really, really struggled with whether to keep the name or not. We knew that changing it could be a really unpopular decision here in town, and we nearly kept it for that exact reason. But as we considered all that we had hoped for this place to be, what we wanted this new iteration of this old restaurant to be, we quickly realized that the new hope and the old name were diametrically opposed. After much deliberation, we decided to name the cafe Magnolia Table. We chose this name because we wanted our restaurant to be a clear representation of a place where all were welcome. The former slogan was, "Where the elite come to eat." To us, the word elite speaks of some form of separation, a divide. Maybe us versus them, the haves and the have-nots. We are finding a lot of ways to honor the heritage of this historic cafe through the renovation process, and we are thankful that we get to build upon the legacy with this new rallying cry of sorts, one that gives everyone a seat at our table. I've talked about the dining table as being a place where enemies are lost and friendships are forged, where people really hear one another out. Magnolia Table is our symbolic offering to that cause. We hope it becomes a place where people come to this community table, enjoy great food, and actually talk with strangers that are outside their group, where instead of worrying about their differences, they find those precious similarities. Ultimately, we really aren't so different from one another after all. If we could just get back to remembering that, then I think that there's some real hope for us yet. Up until this point in life, I have never given one second thought to the idea of bridge building, but Joanna and I were pretty dismayed throughout this past election year at how our beloved nation was behaving. It was bad. Election years have always been brutal, I get that, but this last one was an entirely different magnitude to me. The hate and the fear and the overall discord just felt tangible. I remember that night when Joe and I stayed up late, talking about what could be done. How do people move beyond these party lines, beyond religious affiliations, gender, and race? I remember the conversation coming around the idea of bridge building. For as long as we've been together, Joe and I can certainly be accused of being dreamers. We can be idealistic to a fault. And a lot of our late night ideas and dreams and schemes fall to the wayside, even by morning. But this idea of being bridge builders has really stuck with us, especially as we're turning our thoughts forward to the next chapters of our lives. This is really what we want to do. This is who we want to be. The idea of building bridges has become something of a mission to us and our team these days. As of late, our midnight planning sessions are spent dreaming up some sort of bridge building summit, a time and a place where people of all kinds, all backgrounds and mindsets come together to try to help figure out a way forward. It's basically our own version of Abraham Lincoln's cabinet, albeit a lot larger and probably quite a bit rowdier. A short history lesson. Waco Suspension Bridge. The fact that I live in a town with a famous bridge of its own has not been lost on me. The Waco Suspension Bridge was built back in the late 1800s, when Waco began to rival Dallas in size. Because of the sheer number of people flooding into our city, it became clear that a better means of crossing the Brazos River was necessary. Up until the bridge was built, there was no other way to cross the river for 800 miles. So as you can imagine, it attracted people from all over the place simply so they could get to the other side. Such a seemingly simple idea was made possible by this one structure. The Waco Suspension Bridge was the first of its kind in the entire state. But that didn't make it impossible for the engineer and the men who built it from the ground up. It simply made the work they did that much more important. When it was completed, it was the longest single-span suspension bridge west of the Mississippi. This bridge became a magnet, and even then, it was a symbol of unity. It unified both sides of this city, but it also brought all kinds of people together across it, even cattle along the Chisholm Trail. Bridges, when built strong and sure, are powerful to behold, and they change lives. Building bridges is not a new concept, and although I'm not smart enough to be the engineer, even in a figurative bridge like I'm talking about, what I can do is put in the hard work to help it get built. I'm happy to do the grunt work. I'm happy to get in that ditch and help build this thing by the sweat of my brow, hopefully side by side with a lot of other ditch diggers. Digging out the foundation for the piers and the beams of a sizable bridge requires a ton of hard work. I would love to be a part of that. Eventually, I want to be able to stand with the engineers and the other ditch diggers and everyone else, point to that beautiful bridge and say, I was a part of that. We want to hear from you. Bridge Building Summit. Tweet me, at Chipper Gaines, with any ideas that you might have for this Bridge Building Summit that we're working on. We want to hear about the things you feel passionate about and your thoughts on the topic of bridge building in general. Where does the divide affect you personally? When do you feel unheard, unseen, maybe undervalued? What are you afraid of about the direction that we're headed in? What do you think can heal this country, this planet? What messages of hope would you like to share? Also, if you've read a book or watched a film or maybe heard someone talk on this topic that could be valuable to the ongoing effort of this bridge building project, please send me the name or the link or whatever you've got. We want a fully stocked arsenal of resources as we begin to fight this good fight. Chapter 15, The Runway. I've always been taken by the big pecan trees that surround our property. These tall, aged trees are like a welcome committee each time we drive up or pull up to the farmhouse. I could stand there and marvel at the wonder of them. It's not just their beauty that captivates me, although they are beautiful. I like to think about all the things that these mature trees must have seen, the stories that they could tell. Our house was built back in 1885, and I like to imagine that the pioneer who built it surveyed the land and intentionally chose this specific spot, nestled between a grove of young pecan trees, to lay the foundation for his home. He recognized their worth. He knew that one day, years from now, they'd grow to provide shade and protection, and that eventually they'd produce a bountiful, nutritious harvest. So he pruned and tended and watered these beautiful trees. One thing you might not know about pecan trees is that they need about 1 to 2 inches of water a week. So in seasons of drought, he knew these trees wouldn't make it unless he intervened. He had to have known that the harvest would be worth all that work. And though their yield would be small during his lifetime, he knew that years down the road, those trees would start producing larger and larger quantities of pecans. He knew that the next generation, and the generation even after that, would actually be the ones to reap the real harvest. Now, more than 100 years later, my family gets to enjoy these massive pecan trees. We get the opportunity to walk down to this pecan grove and picnic under the shade of these magnificent beauties. And every autumn, when the pecans start to fall, the kids run around and gather them up. Joe makes pies, and we all go down to the seed shop to sell the surplus. That pioneer knew just what he was doing when he chose this exact spot for our home. He knew the hard work he poured into tending to these trees year after year would eventually pay off, and boy did it, even if he wasn't around to see it. He invested in this land even though he knew he probably would never get the chance to fully enjoy the fruits of his labor. Now that's one heck of a legacy. As a 42-year-old, I find it kind of hard to imagine what my legacy might be or what kind of weight it might hold, because honestly, I'm just too young. I haven't earned it yet, but I do think about it, hoping that somebody someday will reap the harvest of what I'm sowing. None of us is an island. What each of us does today will directly affect somebody else down the road. I'm still reaping the harvest of the folks who have gone before me. I'm still living in the warm light of their legacy. When I'm on my deathbed, I don't really want people to remember me for superficial reasons. I hope that when they think of Chip Carter Gaines, they think of me like a runway, that leveled strip of ground that gives aircraft all the space they need to take off and fly. What drives me these days is the idea of being a launching pad for others, someone who empowers people and believes in them, even when sometimes they don't believe in themselves. My dream of becoming a runway for folks is not some random notion that just came to me one day. This idea was modeled for me all my life. I have seen it lived out, and that has dramatically influenced the kind of person I want to be. My first runway was my granddad, JB. He exemplified hard work and lived a simple life. Every day he woke up and put on the same boots and the same jeans and drove the same old truck every day, day in and day out. Even though he wasn't a perfect man, his strengths marked me forever. He instilled in me this unspoken sense of what hard work really looks like. Another inspiration for me is my father-in-law, Jerry. He is a man of few words, but abounding grace. He raised Joe with such intentionality. He had everything to do with her becoming the woman of my dreams. He also got behind my dreams of making it as an entrepreneur and gave me the space to try it my own way, even when sometimes he knew better. And the biggest inspiration of all is my own father, his character, his integrity, and his faithfulness to our family. These are all parts of the legacy that he's left for me, a legacy that future generations will also reap the benefit of. My dad taught me to be a dad. He's selfless to his core. When I lived at home, he was willing to forgo promotions and advancements at work just to have more time to throw a baseball with me in the evenings. He was teaching me the game, but on another level altogether, he was also showing me how to be a man, how to be a father. He taught me the importance and the value of investing in one's family above all else. Dad's belief in me and the blood, sweat, and tears that he invested in me was a major runway in my life. It gave me a foundation so firm that when my baseball dream was crushed, I still had a strong foothold. It took me a while to understand this, but what my father really gave me after all wasn't about baseball. It was about hard work, discipline, and the art of never quitting. Like my dad did for me, I want to spend my life ensuring that others get to live out their dreams. I want to live my life believing in others in a way that helps them to succeed. I want my everyday actions to have far-reaching effects. It's truly my life's mission to empower people to relentlessly chase after their dreams, no matter the cost. To this, I am committed. I'm actually writing this book in hopes that it can be a runway for you to make a real impact rather than just filling a shelf space or collecting dust somewhere. Even if you've never had anyone believe in you, a parent or a coach or a teacher, I hope that in hearing these stories, you'll recognize that I believe in you, that I am confident you are capable of extraordinary things. I hope you'll be empowered to go do something that you never thought you were capable of doing. I hope your story somehow builds on my story and we have a sort of shared legacy. I've gotten to dream up and start quite a few businesses over the years. I've kept most of these businesses under my wings, but I sold a couple along the way. Take my wash and fold business, for instance. I started it as a little tiny laundry service for Baylor kids. But the guys who bought it from me took that original idea and made something extraordinary out of it. I never dreamt that it could be capable of growing into a big, multi-campus operation spreading over several states, but it did, and they made it happen. A few years into marriage, Joe and I had an idea of something that didn't really exist in Waco yet, a collegiate housing development. We bought 11 acres of land to build it on. Then along came a firm who wanted to buy both the land and this concept from us. They took that original idea and implemented it on dozens of campuses across the country. In regards to both of these particular businesses, the people who bought them from me were able to dream much bigger than I ever could have. My part in them wasn't the fancy part, the part that gets all the glory, or where the money's made, or maybe even the recognition. I was the small beginnings, that minor role, but it was still plenty fulfilling to me. Why try to predict what something is capable of or what it's capable of doing? Instead, why not just make a runway for ideas to take flight and then enjoy watching them soar? As to one of the businesses I did keep, Magnolia, now I've spent quite a bit of time thinking about what I hope its future will be. Until recently, I just sort of assumed that my biggest goal for Magnolia was for it to continue forward, growing in size and scope. And yes, I do hope that. I want this company to be sustainable and strong and useful in a way that really exceeds anybody's expectations. But these days, what I want even more is for our employees to know that Joe and I believe in them, that we are championing them. I hope they realize that we want them to dream bigger than they ever have before because it's in their best interest to do so. I want them to fulfill their wildest dreams. Magnolia is just the beginning for them, and I want them to know that the sky is the limit. I am also keenly aware that God has entrusted us with Magnolia for a reason. This little company has always meant more to us than any amount of notoriety or recognition ever could. Magnolia will undoubtedly be an enduring part of what we leave behind. We pray that it will far outlast us. We dream that our children's children will get to see what we've built, and that it would be a monument symbolizing the value of finding joy in very hard work. Joanna and I also strive every day for the work that we do to create lasting, meaningful, and positive change in our people and our community. We want our employees to rise up as leaders in their own right. We want them to follow their dreams, whatever that might be. Go back to school, get that degree, become world-renowned in their fields, or stay at home with their children, if that's what they feel like they're called to do. Even if the company loses our valued employees to these dreams of theirs, that's okay by me. It was our honor to be the runway for them, the launching pad that they needed to go for it. From there, we're anticipating a chain reaction of sorts with exponential impact. We believe our employees will go on to change the world in ways that Joe and I could never attain by ourselves. Our legacy is their legacy, and vice versa. I am a father and a husband, and I always will be. No two ways about that. At the end of the day, I want my four kiddos to know that they are free to do whatever's in their hearts and that they are capable of accomplishing anything that they could ever imagine. There's no cap to the amount of time or resources I would give to my kids if I knew it would help them fulfill their destiny. I want to instill in them that they are competent to go and do anything in the whole wide world if they're willing to do the hard work and set their minds to it. And I'm confident that they're going to blow any of my biggest dreams out of the water. Joe and I have no artificial expectations for our kids, no desire to force them into any particular occupation. In fact, one of our greatest joys of parenting has been watching our little ones start to come into their own individual personalities. It's fun to watch them begin to come into focus along with their own unique talents and preferences. All Joe and I hope to be as parents are careful stewards of our children. We want to observe them and then slowly and carefully help them to identify their God-given strengths. We want to get behind their dreams, and if that changes over time, we want to keep evolving right along with them. Whatever they choose to do, large or small, in the foreground or in the hidden, we want to help them navigate this journey. As parents, we have the unique opportunity to champion our children's dreams in a way that no one else can. We can instill in them the truth that no matter what they choose to do in life, they can change the world. And as long as they know, without a shadow of a doubt, that I gave them a long runway for takeoff, then I'll be satisfied. Chapter 16. Go get 'em. For as long as I can remember, I thought I was going to die young, younger than I am now. Maybe that's why I've worked so hard, so fast, so diligently. And maybe that's why I started working at such a young age. I was racing against some invisible clock. I found this death calculator online. I know this is a bit morbid, but stay with me. Based on my height, my weight, and my body mass index, BMI, along with the fact that I'm pretty active and a non-smoker, I was estimated to leave this earth on June 16th, 2056. I will be 81 years old. Once you see it in black and white like that, life really takes on a bit of a different hue. You start to think about how your obituary might read. I really encourage everyone to do this. It's fascinating, or intriguing, or maybe just eerie, to say the least. And for me, it really brought things into focus. Here's one possibility I came up with. Waco. Chip Carter Gaines, 81, died Friday, June 16th, 2056, at 8:36 p.m., alone in his hospital bed. He leaves behind his former wife, Joanna Stevens, and their four children, Drake Stevens, Ella Rose, Duke Camden, and Emmy K. Carter. Chip's marriage ended in a bitter divorce after an unfortunate run as an ongoing celebrity poker player in the World Series of Poker. Unbeknownst to his wife, he gambled away the entirety of their estate, causing the collapse of his beloved company, Magnolia Inc. The financial infidelity proved more than she could bear. Overcome with shame, he distanced himself from his children, convinced that they were better off without him because of his tainted legacy. Chip grew up as a golden child and lived a charmed life early on. He was a baseball standout in high school, graduated from Baylor University's Hankamer School of Business, and enjoyed a successful career before he downwardly spiraled. His short-lived foray into D-list television culminated in a brief appearance on The Celebrity Apprentice, from which he was eliminated before the first week for insubordination and public urination. Penniless, Chip faded away to live out his life in complete obscurity. Or instead, it could be something more like this. Waco, Chip Carter Gaines, 81, died Friday, June 16th, 2056, at 8:36 p.m., at his family's estate, surrounded by loved ones who were there to usher him into eternity. He leaves behind his beloved wife of 53 years, Joanna, and his four children, whom he adored. Drake Stevens, real estate tycoon and president of Magnolia Inc. Ella Rose, world-renowned interior decorator and style maven. Duke Camden, international luxury real estate architect and developer. And Emmy K. Carter, acting CEO of Magnolia Omnimedia. As well as their supportive spouses, his 16 grandchildren, and countless dear friends. Born in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the son of Robert Kenneth Gaines and Beverly Gail Gaines, he made his home in Waco, Texas. While attending Baylor University, he remained there as a lifelong resident and ardent advocate for the city he so loved. In his early years, Chip excelled in athletics, playing both baseball and football until he graduated from Grapevine High School. He was the team captain in both sports his senior year. He attended Baylor's Hankamer School of Business, later named Gaines International School of Business in his honor, and graduated in 1998 with a business degree with an emphasis on marketing. He and Joanna Lee Stevens were married at Waco's historic Earl Harrison House in 2003. Later that same year, they opened a small home decor store called Magnolia, which grew in size and scope over the next few decades, culminating in a cultural phenomenon in the second half of the century. For four of those years, they were featured on a wildly popular television show called Fixer Upper. In 2017, Chip and Joanna started the Magnolia Foundation, a nonprofit focused on providing orphan care, youth development, housing, and community restoration. Over the course of the last 39 years, the funds raised by the foundation have made massive strides in helping to solve child homelessness and providing world-class entrepreneurial training for at-risk youth. Chip also devoted many hours campaigning and working to lower the poverty rate in his beloved city, and by the time of his death, it had been successfully lowered to less than 6%. In 2040, Chip's bride, Joanna, won a surprising victory in the presidential general election as the first female half-Korean to take the Oval Office. She went on to win a second term. Chip was her running mate and two-term vice president. Though he never acknowledged it, Chip was largely credited with the successful campaign strategies of criminalizing fear-based living and creating a comprehensive strategy for bridge building. In addition to his political contributions, Chip was a lifelong lover of animals, babies, and of course, world peace. He also loved to run, and from age 42 to 81, he completed 16 marathons and participated in 4 Ironman triathlons. An avid humanitarian, he toured the globe as an agent of reconciliation and an ambassador of hope. After his second attempt at retirement, Chip spent the last decade of his life teaching Spanish as a second language, SSL, in Playa del Carmen to aspiring Mexican entrepreneurs. His ashes are being scattered at the Gaines Estate outside of Waco in their southernmost pasture. In lieu of flowers, please make a donation to the Magnolia Foundation in his memory. Spoiler alert, we're all gonna die. I don't care what your death calculator says, whether you're estimated to live 9 years or 90 years. From heaven's perspective, it all happens in the blink of an eye, and death happens to every one of us. I've never been afraid to die, but I've also never been afraid to live. I'm not sure which of these two possibilities scares most folks the most, but I'm guessing it's the really living one. Death is just an instant of time, but life is one of a million choices, 1 million chances to go all in, up the ante, double down, or cash out. To keep choosing to go all in day after day can sound exhausting and scary, but stick with me here. The world is full of people who choose the safe and predictable path. They save for their 401ks and work their fingers to the bone, focused on climbing that corporate ladder all the way to the tippity top. These people spend a considerable amount of time checking off all these invisible boxes. They live in fear that if they don't do this or that and the other to ensure their security, something bad is bound to happen to them. It's the monster lurking in the closet. The thing that goes bump in the night. They can't quite put their finger on it, but that doesn't mean that it's not out there. It's been said that most adults make around 30,000 conscious choices every single day. That is a staggering number. And each one of those decisions has the ability to direct our paths one way or the other. So many things can affect them too. Hunger, fatigue, mood, our spouse's mood, the weather. Anything can play a part. And I'd bet that a good percentage of many people's decisions are made simply because they provide the path of least resistance. Boo! Unfortunately, I think most of us have become subconsciously obsessed with safety and comfort and make our choices accordingly. The problem with that is this. Nothing worthwhile ever comes easy. So behind almost every one of these decisions we make is an even bigger decision. The compass that determines the direction of our lives. Do I want a safe, comfortable, and easy life? Or do I want my days to matter? I'm guessing here that at the end of most people's lives, they're not wishing they'd passed on more promotions or that they'd spend less time with their families. More likely, they're grappling with whether or not they've even made a true impact on this world. I know I'll be asking the same questions of myself. How many people's lives are actually better off because theirs intersected with my own? So I'm urging you here, and myself as well, to find something worthwhile in this one invaluable life of ours. Find something to fight for. Find something to live for. You may already know the thing that you were created for, and you may already be getting after it. If that's your story, I salute you for making things happen. I get excited thinking about a world where everyone is living out their dreams for the greater good. but it terrifies me to think that we might be living in a world with more armchair critics than torchbearers. I value both logic and passion. To me, they are both essential. Logic serves in many critical ways, helping keep us organized and make sensible decisions. But there is one job that it is utterly ineffective at. It cannot provide powerful motivation. That's what passion is for. Even if your passion is to be an accountant, arguably the most logical career you could possibly choose, logic isn't what stirs you as you create spreadsheets and analyze numbers. Passion is. A logical approach makes a strong case for a safe major at a respected university. It paves the way for a high-paying job due to your sought-after skill set. Logic alone is not enough to convince you to be an artist, but a passion for art may well motivate you to go in that direction. Any well-intentioned dad will tell you that seeking a career in art is impractical, but it sure wasn't for Picasso. Yeah, it might be hard to find a job after graduation. The word most commonly associated with artist is starving, after all. So why on earth would you even consider that as a career? Because of passion. Because that little voice, the one not swayed by fear, is encouraging you to go get after it. Passion is the thing that reminds you that no matter how seemingly unlikely, your art could impart something important to our planet. That using your God-given talent can't not improve the plight of mankind. That's why talents are called gifts, because they're meant to be shared. When you combine this kind of bold bravery with the calling you're passionate about, you become a force to be reckoned with. Finding your passion may not be as easy as it sounds. A lot of people simply have no clue to what they even want to give their precious life for, or at the very least, their time. If that's true, let me see if I can help you out a little bit. Take a look at some of the different facets of society. Government, science, technology, education, family, economy, military, faith and religion, media, business, sports, arts and entertainment. It doesn't take a genius to recognize that each of these categories, each and every aspect of our world, has some real room for improvement. Read through that list again, more slowly this next time. Do any of these resonate with you? Maybe you feel angry about the current state of affairs in one or more of these categories. Or maybe when you were a kid, you dreamt of working in one of these specific fields. Any emotion that is stirred in you by this exercise is not random. These feelings are smoke signals. And of course, where there's smoke, there's fire. People tend to associate fire with something negative. But fire is the palpable ingredient of passion. Fire is a cleansing energy, a channel for a fresh start, for change. When you think of a forest fire rolling through miles and miles of overgrown trees and brush, think of it like this. After an event like that, the nutrients in trees and plants are burned into ash, and then they are returned to the soil to support new growth. Brush and weeds are cleared to make way for smaller trees to thrive without competition. Harmful insects and diseases are completely wiped out. Sunlight is able to reach the forest floor, which means wildflowers will begin popping up through places that haven't seen new life for years. I'm getting at the fact that a fire sometimes burns away the unnecessary to make room for the beautiful. If there's something stirring in you now, and you know what it is, do that. There's no need to overthink it. A mistake here and there isn't going to kill anybody, so don't waste any time worrying about it. It's infinitely better to fail with courage than it is to sit idle with fear, because only one of these gives you the slightest chance to live abundantly. If you do fail, then the worst case scenario is that you'll learn something from it. You are for sure not going to learn jack squat just sitting around and playing it safe. There's actual real work to do. And now's the time to do it. Not one of us is getting any younger, and waiting for your perfect moment or for the most convenient time could very well turn into a missed opportunity. You've been given everything you need to call the shots and to make things happen. You were built for this, so go get to work. If you are working in a cubicle at some company, shuffling from meeting to meeting, and you feel invisible, then go find something that inspires you, something you can give yourself to after you punch out for the day. The quality of the work you do from 8 to 5 will reflect that decision. You may be in your 60s, feeling that you've already missed your shot. If your death calculator is anything like mine, you've still got a good couple of decades to spare. It's definitely not too late. Until that buzzer rings, it ain't over. No one is disqualified from running this race. I believe each one of you still has important things to do, or you wouldn't still be here on Earth. Hear me now. If you are able to listen to this book, you are able to change the world. It might be through small, everyday choices, but those initial sparks can set the entire world afire. As for me, all I've ever wanted, when you get right down to it, is to change the world. I don't literally mean the whole world. That would be nice, I guess, but what I really care about is changing the world around me. This means pouring into the lives of my wife and my kids and my employees, my friends, and even my acquaintances. That's the ripple effect that I've always hoped to put into motion. Rather than taking the easy way out, I learned to trust myself. That voice we hear when we're thinking about going out on a limb, tune into it. There's one thing I want to leave you with. Trusting your gut is the first step. Although that first step won't be enough to get you across the finish line, it's definitely the hardest and the most important of every single one that follows. Plus, once you've gotten started, you won't want to stop. Momentum, remember? Complacency is the enemy, and getting started is as triumphant as crossing the finish line. Your goal is too far off to have a straight line of sight to it, but I'm going to need you to keep it firmly fixed in your mind's eye. The only way this is going to work, the only way you're going to get there, is one foot in front of the other. You have to keep moving. Keep pushing forward. And when you think you're about to die, trust me, it's just a little bit further. All of your life has been preparing you for this exact moment in time. I get that you may not even know what your next chapter holds. I don't know what mine holds either. For Joe and me, the future is nothing but blank pages before us, but we've already started writing on them. Thanks for taking the time to hear my story. And if you will, make one commitment for me. Live a life worthy of being written down, so that at the next go round, how about I'm reading your story? I can't wait to hear it. What are you waiting for? Go get 'em.
From the Desk of Chip Gaines, read by Chip Gaines, with Melinda Paul, Rachel Agee, and Gabe Wicks. Elizabeth.
When I went in for my interview, all I really wanted was a quaint part-time job at this new trendy store in town. I remember Joe talking about what Chip needed. He likes good communication, she said. Always reply to every single text message with at least an okay or a got it. He needs you to show initiative, drive, and a can-do attitude. I went back to meet with Chip at 2 in the afternoon, and our interview didn't end until around 5, when everyone was leaving the office for the day. I barely spoke during the entire interview. Chip remembers me as shy and mute. I remember Chip using lawyers and football coaches as metaphors for most of the points he made. I'm not sure if he even asked me any questions. I think he just talked to me the whole time like a coach. Hey, kiddo, here's what it's like here. Here's what you need to do this job well. I remember Chip would come in during filming breaks and give office-wide pep talks. Usually his first stop was the design girls, and then he'd come sit in my office, take off his insanely stinky 10-year-old boots, throw them into the hallway, and put his feet up on my desk. He'd literally heckle me, listening to me answer the phone and even sometimes taking some calls himself. He'd ask about the emails I was getting, wave to people in the shop windows, and get up to take photos with them. Oh, and of course he'd tweet nonstop. He'd quickly proved his integrity and his love for people. He took every opportunity to be kind and generous, to encourage his family, and to invest in those around him. He is a true discipler. He doesn't take the quick road. He gets into the mud with people and helps them grow. He wants to see people succeed. He celebrates people when they surpass their own expectations. And those are just a few of the really special things about Chip. Once Chip was out of town for the weekend, and he left me with a few simple tasks. He wanted me to get him alone, buy a houseboat and preferably a couple of jet skis too, and get the boat docked in Lake Waco in a slip on the end of the dock. Spending someone else's money on big, important things like that is scary. The bank was giving me a hard time with the loan, but I knew Chip wouldn't take no for an answer. I was literally one stressful phone call away from taking the money out of my personal savings account. I was still so new and wasn't in a position to mess this up. I remember running all around Lake Waco begging people for the boat slip. Actually, getting the boat to the marina was a whole other ordeal. But somehow or other, it all ended up working out, and I didn't get myself fired on that one. While on a trip to New York, Chip and Joe had seen some crazy nice apartment for sale. He called me and said, "Okay, Elizabeth, I need you to take this very seriously. Call these guys and find out how much this apartment is listed for. If you sound like you don't know what you're talking about, they won't talk to you. If you don't sound like an adult, they will hang up on you. You have to sound like a grown-up real estate professional." Oh, crap. I have the voice of a 13-year-old, and I don't know what I'm talking about. But no way was I going to fail this challenge. I called my dad and had him tell me exactly what I should say to make these guys take me seriously. So full of nerves, and wanting to get this right, I called the listing agent. We talked, and he gave me the price, which was something like $40 million. So I texted Chip and gave him that message. His response? Well, shoot. I owe Joe $5. Really? I'd been stressing over this big assignment, and it was all over a bet with Joe? One day, Chip was in the office and heard the music duo Johnny Swim's song, Home, playing in the store. As far as I know, this was the first time he had heard the song, and he thought it would be perfect for the opening of the show. He told me, "Get that song as our theme song." I emailed Sony and got a reply. I ended up on the phone with a Sony rep, then with Johnny Swim's agent, and then with Abner and Amanda, the members of Johnny Swim, themselves. Abner's family were fans of the show, and they thought it would be so fun to have their song as the theme song. I called Chip and told him the good news. He asked me how much it was going to cost, and I thought, oh, I didn't even ask them about a price, but they are fans, and they want to be on the show. So I told Chip it was going to be free. He said, no way. Yeah, I told him, for sure it's free. He said, Elizabeth, Sony is not going to give us a song for free. Call them back and ask the price. I was embarrassed to ask, but I did it. Turns out it was not free. It was really not free. I hated to call Chip back and tell him I was wrong and admit how naive I was, but thankfully he just chalked it up to a learning experience. Get Dolly pregnant was on my to-do list for months. Chip had a horse that he wanted to have bred, and this became my personal responsibility. With the help of a breeder, a stud, and months of horse matchmaking, she finally got pregnant. I'm not going to lie to you, but the length of detail that the vet went into when he explained things had me blushing for weeks. Chip is a saint. I literally didn't know anything about anything when I was hired, and he was the most gracious person during my time at Magnolia. He taught me so much. I truly credit him for helping me grow up, and he literally made me feel like I could do anything.
Richard. Once, Chip had me go buy a pig for him. When I got back to the farm, I let the pig out in the pasture with the other animals, and he immediately ran away. I spent half the night trying to find this animal and was sure he'd been eaten by coyotes. Probably not my best first impression as Chip's assistant. Probably the most stomach-dropping moment was the time I accidentally sent a direct message to Steve Forbes from Chip's Twitter account. Maybe it wasn't that big of a deal, but Chip's Twitter is like a woman's purse. You don't mess with it. Speaking of Twitter, once Chip tweeted out that I was single and that everyone should follow me. Embarrassing. I had multiple grandmothers send me pictures of their granddaughters. Oh, and more animal purchases. He had me buy goats. And then more goats. Then he asked me to breed the goats. This was a big learning experience for me. Beth.
I get asked the question all the time, what's it like working for Chip? Is he as funny in real life as he is on TV? The answer to that question is a resounding yes. I remember my first day of work. Joanna was out of the office working on the finishing touches for a fixer-upper house. Chip welcomed me to Magnolia, and we chatted in the office for a while. He told me to take it easy for the first 6 months or so of employment so that I could learn my way around and get acquainted with people. After that, we would really get to work, and I was thinking to myself, no, 6 months with nothing to do. I will die of boredom if they don't give me any work. I need not have worried. Less than 20 minutes later, he bounded out of the office and gave me my first assignment. Never mind the 6 month wait, he said. I need you to register our chickens with the Texas Department of Poultry so my girls can sell baby chicks. Did I hear him right? Chickens? Yep, that's right. Before I knew it, I had made arrangements to meet with the poultry inspector at the farm so that the chicks could be approved for sale. And that's how the wild adventure of working for Chip began. I never know what I'll be doing for Chip from day to day. One day, he came flying through the office door, running late for a meeting. He called to me and he said, Beth, it's kind of a long story, but I picked up a homeless guy and he's sitting outside in the parking lot. Can you go out there, talk to him, and find him a job? And off he went into his meeting. With a little trepidation, I walked outside and met Mike, not his real name. He told me his story, and I asked him what kind of work experience he had. He was down on his luck, but I really believed there was hope for this guy. I called the warehouse manager, and we set up a plan to find him a job. We even scheduled an interview. Unfortunately, Mike's story did not end well. Despite our making every effort and giving him several chances, he never showed up for the interview, and we lost touch with him. But even though this endeavor did not turn out like we hoped, it was worth the effort. You never know. Chip might have been the only person to ever believe in him. Someday, Mike might be ready to make a change and remember that someone gave him a chance. Within my first week of work, Chip asked me if I had a Twitter account. I had never really used Twitter and didn't know that much about it. Chip told me I'd better get set up and quickly because he loves to use Twitter to connect with people. With a little help from our social media director, my account was set up, and that's when I became at Assisting Chip. Chip's Twitter giveaways quickly became one of my favorite things about working for him. He has given away everything from all-expenses-paid trips to Waco to a Jimmy Don Holmes sign that someone saw on the show and loved, T-shirts, hats, demo day hammers, concert tickets, Broadway tickets in New York City, school tuition, whatever captures his attention is fair game for a giveaway. I love to make these things happen, and the joy that they bring to people makes me so happy. It feels like Christmas all year round. Working for both Chip and Joanna is a real juggling act. As their executive assistant, I manage many aspects of their business and personal lives, from working with producers on the filming schedule to meeting with executives, making last-minute travel plans, and taking care of their vehicles and home projects. Every day is different, and there's never a dull moment. One time, Joanna was getting ready to go out of town for a meeting, and she asked me to have some work done on her car to get it ready to sell while she was gone. I scheduled the appointment and dropped off the car to have it repaired. Later in the day, Chip called me and asked what was happening with her vehicle. I relayed Joanna's instructions to take it to the shop, and Chip told me to hold off on that repair for the time being. When I explained that Joanna wanted this done, he gave me an interesting answer that made me laugh. As only Chip could do, he exclaimed, "Welcome to our world! People are always asking us who's in charge, and the answer is, when Joe is gone, I'm the boss."
What do workers gain from toil? I have seen the burden God has laid on the human race. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the human heart. Yet no one can fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. I know that there is nothing better for people than to be happy and to do good while they live, that each of them may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all their toil. This is the gift of God. Ecclesiastes 3:9-13.
So I'd say it was a little different the way I remembered it when you were falling off that four-wheeler. I think in your mind it was heroic. It was like the Superman flying off.